It is Friday, March 18th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, a VOA reporter covering the case of an American militant who quit the Islamic State group gives us his reaction to an interview the man gave to Kurdish television. We'll get an update from our correspondent in Europe to breaking news of a deal between EU leaders and Turkey to resolve the region's migrant crisis. And international artists gather in the southern U.S. city of Austin, Texas, for the biggest music festival of its kind.
We're very happy that from Bangladesh, for the first time, any band can perform at South by Southwest.
It's all ahead on International Edition. U.S. intelligence officials are taking a close look at what an American Islamic State fighter is telling Kurdish media. Mohammed Jamal Hues, a 26-year-old from the U.S. city of Alexandria, Virginia, spoke to an Iraqi Kurdish TV channel just days after he claims to have fled from the IS-held city of Mosul. Kurdish forces saw him wandering near the northern Iraqi city of Sinjar on Monday and fired upon him before he surrendered to them. Sirwan Kajo is a VOA journalist with our Extremism Watch Desk. He's been following the case, and I asked him earlier what he makes of that interview on Iraqi Kurdish TV.
So there were a lot of new information that Hues reported in the interview, things that we did not know early on when we first reported the story, how dissatisfied he was with the Islamic State, all the promises that were made prior to his departure for Syria to join the Islamic State, and all the things that he knew or hoped to see in the Islamic State were false, according to what he said in the interview.
Like what things?
For example, the way they were treating the foreign fighters in Syria and Iraq, especially in Syria, and that the majority of Islamic State fighters are foreigner, yet they were still treated differently from the rest of Arab fighters in the group. So, and also how things were different in the way they were treating women and how everything was different from what Mohammed Hues was used to.
In America, right?
Exactly.
Quite a different lifestyle. So I understand you met the parents of Mohammed Jamal Hues earlier this week and actually broke the news to them that he had been detained in Iraqi Kurdistan. What reaction has there been from his parents to this interview that was just broadcast?
So VOA was the first news organization that got to talk to the family. And like you said, we broke the news to them. And in the beginning, they were, you know, they didn't believe what I was telling them until I showed them the picture of their son captured by the Kurdish Peshmerga in Iraqi Kurdistan. But then we stayed in touch afterward until early this morning after this K24 interview was broadcast. And there was no response from them. Apparently, the family doesn't want to comment further about these kind of emerging details. Now they know that their son is indeed in Iraq and he has been captured by the Kurds. But in the beginning, it was very important that they kept denying that their son was in the Middle East. They thought, that's what they said at least, that their son this whole period was based in Canada.
Yeah, now there's, I think, very strong evidence that he has in fact been in the Middle East. So how significant is the fact that Mohammed Jamal Hues did this interview and went public with the fact that he had a bad experience of the Islamic State?
Very significant, because he talks about all the negative things that ISIS has been doing, and that's what the U.S. and its coalition partners have been promoting, you know, basically saying and reiterating what U.S. officials and Western officials have been saying about ISIS and its atrocities and its everything that ISIS does on the ground. Mohammed, basically, as a former ISIS member, told what the situation it is on the ground, because it's really hard to say it. And he was the first ISIS defector to talk about his bad experience with the terror group.
Well, thanks so much to VOA reporter Sirwan Kajo of the VOA Extremism Watch Desk for bringing us the latest on the case of Mohammed Jamal Hues.
Thank you, Michael.
Segment, and I'm joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Andrew, what is going on with social media today?
Well, the big breaking story right now in the news and on social media is the apparent arrest of Salah Abdeslam. He was, of course, one of the attackers in the Paris attacks in November of last year that killed over 130 people. And so he has been apparently captured in Belgium. So he was receiving a lot of photos from the scene, updates from the scene.
Right, the news is breaking now, isn't it?
The news is breaking as we speak. And in fact, a lot of the social media conversation is just people trying to confirm this news, saying, is this actually true? Are we trying to, you know, just, are we getting ahead of ourselves, or have we actually captured him?
It's a typical response when news is unfolding like this, isn't it?
Absolutely. And then the interesting thing with social media, too, is you begin to see photos from other scenes. So I saw one photo someone had posted from a train station in Belgium saying they saw increased security. So you're getting a broader picture of what's going on. Other than this one raid where they've captured this man, you're seeing the effects kind of resonate throughout Belgium and throughout Europe.
Yeah, and Brussels is quite a wired city, so I'd imagine a lot of people in Brussels itself are sharing what they can see on social media, right?
Absolutely, and it's a big international city, so you're seeing a lot of different languages. The things I was seeing was in English, but you're seeing in French
as well,
German, other languages as well.
Anything else you've got for us today?
Well, the other story here in the U.S. is Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, was running for president, dropped out of the race after a poor performance in his home state of Florida. He's made his first comments after dropping out, and the big news on social media is that he's announced he is going to be out of politics.
He's done.
Senate term is over in 10 months. He said he's going to be a private citizen. He doesn't want to be anyone's vice president, doesn't want to run for governor of Florida.
So he is closing the door.
Closing the door, at least he says for now. And it's something a lot of people on social media pointed out. They said, well, he says this now, but these races could be down the road, maybe something he wants to jump into.
And he's still a young guy, isn't he?
He is. He's about 44 years old, so people said he's still got a lot of time. And a lot of people saying, oh, I feel kind of bad for him. It seems like he really wanted to be president and just didn't get his shot. But more to come on Marco Rubio, no doubt.
Sure. Well, thank you very much to our social media editor, Andrew Polchevsky. You can find him on Twitter at APAL, and I'm there as well at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Diving for pearls, a dangerous profession, and one that for hundreds of years was the main industry for Gulf states. Today, it's oil, but there's a movement to preserve the heritage and to restore the pearl industry in Muharraq, once the diving center of the past, Noor Al-Sayah of UNESCO.
So the idea behind the whole project is also to make pearling a sustainable economy for Bahrain once again.
The discovery of oil and Japan's entrance into the pearl market in 1930 killed the Arabian industry. Today, by protecting offshore oyster beds, Noor Al-Sayah says an old tradition can be maintained.
The diving is going to be regulated there in order to sustain sustainable fishing and pearl diving activity.
The area's museums are luring tourists who now understand how important the pearl industry used to be. And by restoring old pearl houses of yesterday, a new foundation is set to bring back a once-dead pearl economy. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. Well, as we were just saying, there is breaking news out of Brussels, where authorities have apparently apprehended a terror suspect wanted for involvement in last November's terror attacks in Paris. For more on that and other breaking news from Belgium, we have on the line with us from Greece, Jamie Detmer. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for having me on, Michael.
Well, thanks for being here at such short notice. So what more can you tell us about the situation in Brussels with this terror suspect?
Well, we know that there were shots fired this afternoon, more than a dozen. We know that there were two different counter-terrorist raids in Molenbeek, which is a suburb of Brussels, where the attack was planned on Paris by several young men who had lived there. And it has been confirmed by police spokesman to the Belgian media that one of the men they captured and shot was Sailor Abdus-Salam, who has been really Europe's most wanted man since the November Paris attacks. He was a young man who slipped across back into Belgium on the night of the attacks as they were being carried out, or shortly after, and has been on the run ever since. There had been a thought that he had left Belgium and Europe, but last year, towards December, they found his fingerprints in an apartment, and again on Tuesday, during another raid, when a man was shot, an Algerian was shot, and two other suspects escaped, they also found his fingerprints there as well. So this is really a follow-on raid from that Tuesday one. And for the Belgians, it's a big hit. They've been after this man really since November and had thought that he had slipped the net.
Well, again, how significant do you think it is in Europe's fight against terror, the fact that this man has been apprehended?
Well, it's significant, you know, in terms of they can get information from this man. He's alive. He was shot and wounded, but apparently is alive. They are still trying to roll up the cell that he was involved in. It was considered involving about 20 people.
So there could be other people
arrested.
So there could be other people on the run.
There are believed to be out there as well. And any light that they can get from him, they can cast light on other terrorist plans, obviously is significant, will be important.
Right. Well, there are a lot of developments coming out of Belgium today. We also had EU leaders meeting with Turkey to try to figure out what to do about the migrant crisis in the region, and they came to an agreement. Can you tell us something about that?
Well, there's an agreement between the Turkish leaders and the EU on a plan that they've been negotiating for weeks now, although there's still some final approval that's required by the 28 member states later on this afternoon. And the deal basically comes down to the idea that from March the 20th, from Sunday, refugees and migrants who cross the Aegean will be sent back to Turkey after judges look at their applications and there's an appeal process. But basically, they're all going to be sent back. And in return, the EU will take refugees from Turkey. It's meant to be a one-for-one swap. Those who smuggle themselves there get sent back. The ones who play by the EU rules and apply from Turkey will get settled into Europe, but only up to a ceiling of 72,000. Which is a figure which is very close to the one the EU was talking about on another scheme last year, and they've only actually settled about 1,000 out of those applications for about 60,000 to 70,000 places. There are problems with this deal. It's likely to be challenged in the European Court of Human Rights by rights groups, and there are a lot of administrative challenges and legal ones for Greece and Turkey down the line as well.
So a lot of details still to be worked out. Well, thank you very much to our correspondent, Jamie Detmer in Greece, for bringing us the latest on those two breaking stories out of Belgium. Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks very much.
Well, on to Asia, and North Korea has test-fired two ballistic missiles, the latest in a series of rocket launches by Pyongyang. They come a day after U.S. President Barack Obama imposed new sanctions on Pyongyang in response to its recent nuclear test and satellite launch. The latest North Korean missile launches follow a familiar pattern of defiance by Pyongyang in the face of punitive steps by the international community. I spoke to VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Padden a few hours ago, and I asked him what more is known about the missiles that were fired on Friday.
Well, they were launched early Friday morning. They were two medium-range ballistic missiles. They're called Rodong missiles. They are kind of a Scud missile, which can reach about 1,000 kilometers, could reach up to Japan. These two fired, when they were fired, they reached about 800 kilometers into the sea, not quite the distance to Japan. And one of them, it was reported that it might have exploded mid-flight.
Which is a sign of apparent failure of that missile?
I'm not sure about that. It might be the sign of failure. It was certainly a test flight. And it's part of what Pyongyang has been doing, or at least it has been accelerated in its process of developing its ballistic missile technology and its nuclear capability in the last year. And so while it may have been somewhat of a failure, it's also a process for learning how to improve for the next time.
Well, how concerned are South Koreans about North Korea's advancement of its missile program, even though it's relatively gradual?
I think there's a lot of concern here in South Korea. What you have seen over the last couple of years, you have seen two things. One, amongst the population, you have seen kind of people being accustomed to this constant reporting of provocations and crisis, and then the crisis kind of dissipates, and then they move on to the next kind of show of force. So people have become a bit numb to that. But on a greater scale, and particularly on government to government, they have become much more conservative in their approach, much less willing to give North Korea the benefit of the doubt, much less willing to negotiate over these issues. And so it's become a harder line standoff between the two sides.
Do you think there's any indication that the South Korean government will impose even more sanctions on the North because of this launch and hence kind of perpetuate this cycle?
If they could, they would. They've kind of hit the limit in what they could do. They closed perhaps the last remaining significant economic link between the two sides a few weeks ago when they closed this Kaesong project, putting out of work 53,000 North Koreans. They are banning North Korean ships from their ports. They are banning third parties from doing business with North Korea. So they're trying to do what they can to set an example to hold a hard line in trying to put economic pressure and impose harsh sanctions on North Korea.
Well, thank you very much to our Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Patton for bringing us that update.
All right. Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The dwarf planet Ceres is the largest body in the asteroid belt. Among the features of the dwarf planet are several bright spots on its surface. The most noticeable spots are located within its Achator crater. Some scientists think that this might indicate that Ceres is more active than any neighbors in the asteroid belt. Now, scientists using the HARPS spectrograph at the European Southern Observatory in Chile have found that these bright spots go through some surprising changes. While the spots have been known to change as Ceres rotates, the scientists have also found that they also vary and brighten during the day. The scientists say that their observations suggest that the bright spots may be made up of a volatile substance and that solar radiation may cause it to evaporate. NASA's Dawn spacecraft has been circling and studying Ceres and its mysterious bright spots since it arrived there about a year ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. It's time now for a check of the markets, and I spoke earlier to our financial reporter Jill Malandrino in New York to find out how Wall Street has been able to rally for five straight weeks.
The rally's been quite impressive. We have risen over 250 points in the S&P 500 since the February 11th low, having been led by energy. Crude oil is back over $40, having been led by the financials, which is a key component of the S&P 500. And this week, what we saw was a big bid in the market because of the Federal Reserve decision to not raise interest rates. And they also cut down their expectations to raise rates two times in 2016. The prior expectation was four times. So they are following the trend with other global central banks where the monetary policy is going to remain easy. And that really put the underlying bid, the bullish momentum that we saw in the market this week.
And that was our financial reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino. The South by Southwest Festival, taking place in the southern U.S. city of Austin, Texas, this week, began in 1987 as a local music event. Now it is the world's largest music festival of its kind, with more than 2,000 performers. As VOA's Greg Flakus reports from Austin, bands from around the world come to the Texas capital city every March, seeking to be discovered or to expand their audience.
At South by Southwest, you can still hear some of the local sound, blending elements of country with rock and other Texas flavors.
We still enjoy our culture, and whether that's Tejano music or country music or whatever that culture is, I think we're trying to embrace all of it.
The diversity of Austin's musical scene was on display at the Austin Music Awards program, held in conjunction with South by Southwest, where new Austin resident Robert Plant, formerly of the British rock group Led Zeppelin, went on stage with such Texas legends as blues guitarist Jimmy Vaughn. But international groups playing at South by Southwest provide a different flavor. Austinites like Susan Peterson attend mainly to hear international groups like Lula Cruza.
I spent about 4 years in West Africa in my 20s, and so Latin beats and African beats really appeal to me. It's music that feels kind of like home to me, but It's also, I love seeing the traditions of other places.
Lula Cruz's lead singer, Alejandra Ortiz, is from Argentina. Her bandmates are from Colombia. Together, they explore both the nature and cultures of the Andean region.
We've done like a lot of deep listening and research in how the sound of an environment creates the music that then becomes part of a culture.
One foreign group that delighted many fans is Chirkut from Bangladesh. Singer Shumi says the band members incorporate traditional music with elements of rock.
We do what we love to do.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe that's the thing. And we are very happy that from Bangladesh, for the first time, any band can perform at South by Southwest.
Chirkut's eclectic approach even includes a banjo. In other songs, the guitarist draws on years of listening to Jimi Hendrix as well as other rock musicians. There are also bands from Europe, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia, and Mexico, adding to the diversity of sounds this year at South by Southwest. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
Well, you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. The show today was brought to you by director Steve Koresh and engineer Charleston Mock. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you'd like to find this show, you can go to the voanews.com website, click on the Programs tab at the top of the page, and then scroll down and click on the link to the International Edition program page. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at @VOA_IE, and I'm on Twitter as well. My handle is @Michael_Lippin. We'd also like to thank our Facebook Live audience for following this show. Lots of breaking news, especially from Belgium. Well, I hope you all have a great week, a great weekend, and we'll see you back next week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Burma's Union Parliament has elected Tin Cho of the National League for Democracy as the country's first truly civilian president in more than 50 years. The presidential election is another important step forward in Burma's democratic transition, noted U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a message of congratulations. Tin Cho is close advisor to National League for Democracy leader and former political prisoner Aung San Suu Kyi. He has worked with her to support Burma's democracy movement since 1992. We commend the people and institutions of Burma who continue to work together to ensure a peaceful transfer of power after the November 2015 elections, said Secretary Kerry. November's elections were another step forward in Burma's historic democratic transition and the culmination of a reform process that started in 2011 with the relaxation of press and internet censorship laws, the release of political prisoners, including Aung San Suu Kyi, and efforts to improve the electoral process. The U.S. supported these reforms by easing sanctions previously levied due to human rights abuses by the country's military junta. The U.S. also provided more than $18 million to assist the electoral process. The National League for Democracy swept the November elections, winning 77% of seats in the Union Parliament and giving it the power to choose the president. Reforms will, however, need to continue. The Burmese constitution reserves 25% of parliamentary seats and key cabinet posts for the military and allows them to name a vice president. State Department spokesman John Kirby calls the allowance of unelected officials a structural and systemic flaw, noting that the people of Burma should be allowed to vote for their leaders of their own choice. The United States remains committed to supporting the people of Burma in their ongoing pursuit of democracy, development, and national reconciliation, said Secretary Kerry. We continue to encourage political and civil leaders to work together in the spirit of national unity and reform.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.